a warm welcome to our Thursdays with David Foster Wallace series, where we every week read a section of the infamous Infinite Jest with the hope, of course, of finishing the book by the end of the year. Today's section is pages 574 to 601 in the 20th anniversary Back Bay Books edition of the text published by Little Brown and Company. There are two articles linked in the description for today's episode. They're both follow-ups from our footnotes episode on Monday. One was provided by a very avid commenter on the show, so thank you so much, Time, for providing that link for us. It's a really interesting article on footnote 24 about Jaim and Candenza's filmography. And there's a lot of really great symbolism in that article. It's really interesting, and they talk about connections specifically with Hamlet in the novel, which I just found really cool because I'm not super well-versed in Shakespeare, but I would like to be, for sure. The second article, is one that I found because I realized we didn't have any negative reviews of Infinite Jest, and I'm so sorry about that. I wish that there was more variety in that episode, so I've provided a negative review in the comments, and this blog that I found, overall, this person did not like Infinite Jest, and I think they do a really good job of holistically reviewing the book from their perspective of reading it. So both of those are there in the comments section if you would like to dive a little bit more into footnotes. Also, avid commenters had a lot to say about the footnote episode, so if you'd like to look at more comments about it, you can go to the link down in the description for comments on today's episode and look that up. So we're starting from page 574 here in the novel. Shorter section today just because the next division was a little bit awkward and it's 20 or 30 pages further in the text than we are for this week, so we're starting with selected snippets from the individual, resident, informal interface moments of D.W. Gately, live-in staff, Ennett House, Drug and Alcohol Recovery House, that is D-A-R-H, the acronym I didn't know from a couple episodes ago, Enfield, Massachusetts, on and off from just after the Brookline Young People's AA meeting up to about 23-29 hours, Wednesday, 11th November, YDAU. That whole title page that I just read is on page 563, and page 574, and indeed all the way up until our end section today, we are completely and totally within this one chapter heading, so that's another interesting thing, is that we have this long chapter heading, and it's a preface for such a long section in the book. So today's section, I will admit, doesn't have much plot, so I will probably do a very minimal overview of plot today, just because there's not a lot that we can cover within the episode, but we will be talking about themes much more than we usually do. This is sort of our substitute for when the plot doesn't serve us super well in an episode. So we start out with a vignette here on page 574 with Oren. And he's figuring out something still about the wheelchair assassins. We had a very informative conversation between him and Hal earlier in the novel about their respective theories on what the wheelchair assassins are, what Oren thinks is a disabled fan club, why these people are following Oren, and Hal is thinking, maybe there's something more here. Oren just thinks it's sort of an interestingly formed fan club just based around him. Steeply here is framed as a sort of protector for Oren, and I find that really interesting because Steeply is really seen with very critical eyes when we're looking through Murray's eyes in the mountains of Tucson as they're meeting for many, many hours on the mountains at night and then at dawn. But here, Steeply is really framed as someone who keeps these wheelchair assassins, or what we think at this point, us readers, to be wheelchair assassins at bay. And likely because the wheelchair assassins, or whomever is really trying to get to Oren, does not want Steeply to know that they're trying to get to Oren. And maybe they're trying to get to Oren in a similar way that Steeply is. And I find it interesting that Oren is this character that seems like a vessel of information that they really want to get at for some sort of strategizing or other. And we do have to remember, Oren is the son of the creator of Infinite Jest, so he is of utmost importance to people to try to get background on Infinite Jest, why this cartridge was made, or why this cartridge may be so lethal, where this cartridge, in terms of ideology, comes from. And so I think that's one thing just to remember. And another structural important detail that I was thinking about was that this passage, or the way this passage or this narrative thread has been introduced in the novel in these short snippets, with Oren driving Helen to the airport and then having this brief affair with the Swiss hand model. That has been integrated into the structure of the novel very much in the same way as the medical attaché's narrative was integrated. So I find that really interesting how Oren has become sort of this substitute midway through the novel for the medical attaché narrative in the beginning. The next sub thread that we have here is Lens and Green again. They're walking back from an AA meeting or an NA meeting, and Lens is having symptoms from the drugs he's been doing, unsurprisingly, but quoted later in the text is that it's unclear whether Green knows that Lens is getting high off of these drugs. And at the beginning of this section, I literally wrote down in my notebook, aha, Green knows that Lens is doing drugs, essentially. And later in the narrative corrects our thoughts. And so I find it really cool that the narrator anticipated our assumptions in this regard, and the narrator takes great care to mitigate any sort of assumptions that we're making in terms of Green's perceptiveness about Lens. We also learn that Charlotte Treat, an aside sort of part of this narrative, that Charlotte Treat would like to go into dentistry after she's recovered and everything, and her father was a dental anesthesiologist, essentially. And what's hard about this is something maybe that many people wouldn't gather from this comment, which is that anesthesiologists have some of the highest rates of drug abuse in all of medicine, and this is something that makes this Charlotte Treat issue or dream very sensitive, notwithstanding the fact that her father also was a dental anesthesiologist and also abused these kind of drugs and these kinds of practices. So it's something that I think is very telling about Charlotte Treat's maybe her vulnerability with Green in that moment while she was talking to him. Lens's mother. So Lens's mother was morbidly obese, and there's lots of stories in this thread today, actually. So Lens's mother, she was morbidly obese. She gets on a greyhound to go visit Lens, and she is in the small bathroom receptacle of the greyhound, and let's just say it was winter and some part of her body got stuck in the window and was subjected to frostbite when the bus started having difficulty in a construction zone. The bus got in a bad position and started jostling around and whatnot, and Mrs. Lens was harmed in some way because of that, and she couldn't get out of the bathroom in a timely manner and everything. So she was probably pretty traumatized from that experience, seems like, and she got a massive settlement from the Greyhound company, and she ended up losing all motivation to do anything, to work, to do anything except eat a large amount. So she buys essentially the services of a pastry chef round the clock, and she is able to just eat pastries until she eventually dies. And so Lenz is talking about maybe his potential trauma from his mother and how he never got any inheritance from her because of the pastry chef and other people around her being really greedy. One thing I forgot to mention, the quote, quote, "It's unclear whether Green knows Lenz is under the influence of the drug." That quote is on page 578, if you would like to reference that. And this Lenz's mother's story, to get back to our main topic here, is juxtaposed with Green's father's story. And this is a similar sort of story, and I love how visual the section is. I really got lost in some of these smaller chapters here, and I loved that the tone really shifts here, where the narrator isn't really stating these bare facts anymore. It's the style is similar, but I will say the tone is very much more committed to a narrative arc at this point in the novel. And I think that relates to something that we will talk about a little bit later in the episode. So, Green's father, he was a famous aerobics instructor or performer, something along these lines. And at one point in his career, he was in his, just the high point of his career, one of his legs started growing. In the narrative, it's not clear whether one leg started growing or one started shrinking, not important, but one leg ended up 6 inches longer than the other. So his father, Green's father, had to wear this huge boot, essentially, to offset the difference between his legs. And so he always walked with this really disturbing, it seems like a disturbing lurch, like he was constantly off balance or on a ship or something. And so after this aerobics career, his father goes into the gags business essentially and starts making those hand buzzers that shock your hand when you shake someone's hand, or dandruff powder was mentioned, and also a gag that we will mention in a minute. So both of their parents, both Green's father and Lenz's mother, they have this window into our theme of superficiality in the novel. And so I'm wondering, is our character's exhaustion with that theme in their parents something that makes drugs more attractive to them, makes them more interested maybe in this kind of escapist lifestyle that they live? So Green, we have a more direct window in this thread, at least in this section, to his psychological state, and he is repressing, repressing. He doesn't think very fast. He thinks about one full thought per minute, so that's very, very slow. And he's dealing with quite a lot in his sobriety that I think was definitely repressed and definitely not dealt with to the same degree when he was using. And I wonder the effect of this superficiality that both their parents really suffered from on these now children, now adults. So Lenz's mother, she had this sort of physical obesity problem, and then Lenz's father, or sorry, Green's father, had this physical problem, much like some of the problems that Madame Psychosis was talking about in some of her shows, and that we've been seeing all along the way in Infinite Jest, whether it's because of this toxic waste situation with the Great Concavity or Mario's situation, for example. So this theme of physicality and also of superficiality, food, I think, becomes very superficial in Lenz's mother's story. But yeah, these themes are very, very connected. And I'm wondering, what do you all think about that? And what other further connections can you make that I'm maybe missing or am about to make here? So Green's mother died on Christmas morning. after receiving a gag gift from Bruce Green. So he was 5 years old at this time, and she loved these macadamia nuts, and so Bruce gets her a can of macadamia nuts, except there's a trick. There's a snake in, you know, a pop-out snake in the can of macadamia nuts. When she opens it, she's so surprised that she has a coronary, and she dies. And so she dies, and Bruce is left, and the father is not doing well, and he ends up doing what we would consider nowadays sort of a terrorist-like action. He rigs some smoke cigars, some play cigars with real explosives, and so he gets the death sentence for that. And the father ends up also dying because he's executed by people who have convicted him, and Bruce Green goes and lives with his aunt. And so there's a lot of jumbled thoughts around this section, especially as the section gets more involved, more complicated, and he's remembering little snippets of his parents and his aunt. And so his aunt is a religious devotee of some sort, and she just has some odd behavior. One trait that stuck out to me in the narrative for some reason is that she had hair parted down the middle, as do I. I was wondering, you know, is that a sign of something? not sure, but very, very interesting. Getting back to the main narrative in this Bruce Lens section, Green, it appears, has lost Lens. So Lens frequently has to go to the bathroom during their walks, and Green essentially just turns his back in an alleyway and starts walking after a little bit of time. Then I think Lens probably has just run away at this point. That's what popped into my mind when I first read this section. I have a quote from page 582 to 583. Quote, "The street's bare trees are densely limbed. They're a certain type of tree. They look like inverted brooms in the residential dark. Green doesn't know his tree names." And I love that quote. I love it because at this point in the narrative, when Green loses Lens, we start getting really the process of Green's thoughts. And I love the evolution of this sentence in particular. I think it's particularly telling for the narrative structure as a whole here. So the street's bare trees are densely limbed. So we're talking about an observation. It's something very external to the world, something you would notice first. They're a certain type of tree. Okay, well, this is obvious to anyone, right? Obviously, any tree that you observe is going to be a certain type of tree, and that maybe there's more there. Maybe there's more meaning that we can parse out in that a certain type of tree. Maybe that's recognizable to Green, recognizable to people in this area of Boston, maybe recognizable to a certain part of Green's childhood, maybe special in some way to Green. But again, another very general comment. It's not very observant at this point. They look like inverted brooms in the residential dark. I love that description. I think that's what made me write this quote down more than anything, is this inverted broom quality. Because what would an inverted broom look like? And that's just such a visual, creative way to describe something we've seen a million times. And so that's really the personality of this quote, is two-thirds in, where we're, you know, getting past the superficiality of what Green is observing, or what the narrator is observing through Green's lens here. And we're really getting this, again, this little nugget, this golden nugget of personality. And Green doesn't know his tree names. And so it's the ultimate sort of slap in the face, a reversal. It's sort of like you have a thought that's really flowing, and then it abruptly stops when you are mid-sentence. And so we're really interrupted here, and we're effaced by the fact that Green doesn't know his tree names. It's sort of a rebuke in some ways of the text against the reader. And I love that, how it, again, demonstrates the larger narrative structure of Green's thoughts as a whole. And so we already know this narrator of ours is very adaptive, and this is just another example of that. We have this story. It starts near page 585. And the story is in this broader outer frame that we have, at least in terms of this episode. There's a larger frame as a whole because the whole novel is in double quotation marks, which we'll talk about later more. It's relevant more for later. But here in this outer frame, for our purposes, where Lens is amiss somehow, we're not sure where he is. He's somewhere, and Green is trying to find him. That's the outer frame I'm talking about. There's Hawaiian music, and so Green comes across Lens sort of randomly, it seems like. He talks about going in a southward direction, which we know is not typical for Lens, and so it's sort of a surprise that we come across Lens, and that also a surprise that this Hawaiian music is the trigger that brings us to Lens. And Lens is doing something suspicious. We already know at this point what he's doing, of course, but Green does not know that, so we get to see what Lens is doing from Green's eyes, which is, yeah. Lens is taunting a large dog of some sort, so he's really taking out some of his anger, right, and feelings of loss of control on this dog. And within this story, there's another story. So there's another frame here that's closer in to Green, and Green is talking about a story about a Hawaiian-themed party at Harvard that he and Mildred Bonk went to, and Mildred was 7 months pregnant during this time, and Green ended up drinking way too much, and he became incontinent, and the story progresses from there. I won't give you too many of the gory details for that one. But what's interesting to me is that, and again, maybe you wouldn't care about this detail if you were reading the text, but on page 585, there's a reference to the kind of person that Mildred was talking to after Green left and essentially abandoned her because he was having some personal issues that he had to resolve in private, or sort of in private. He had to get home to solve those. On page 585, there's a reference to Dürer, which he, or Dürer, is a painter from Nuremberg, Germany, in the 16th century. And Dürer was famous really at a time when Nuremberg was considered to be the capital of Europe in a lot of ways. And so Nuremberg was an especially important city during this time. Interestingly, part of my senior thesis has to do all about Nuremberg and Dürer and his influences. So the kind of person that they describe really hits on a lot of deep cultural and deeply assumptive ties that I find to be really interesting. In any case, we have Lens, and he kills the dog in this gruesome manner with a knife. And Green, of course, observes all of it. And this is a wheel-turning event for Green. So Green, as we know, he has this very pondering way of reaching conclusions. His thought patterns are really slow-moving. But here he gets overwhelmed, and you can see the gears start to turn in this narrative a little more. So there's the music, there's Lens, and the music really seems to bother him. And then there's also Canadians here, which of course we would recognize at this point just because of the huge cultural and also narrative function of Canadians at this point in the text. So oftentimes Canadians are maybe juxtaposed against Americans in certain ways. And so they're in Boston, and these people are instantly recognizable as Canadians. And as we later learn in the narrative, there's wheelchair assassins here. And again, there's sort of this same theme recurring of there's this big, strong dog attacked and destroyed by Lens. And then wheelchair assassins who end up coordinating a chase after Lens. And so there's a sort of physical imbalance between the dog here in this section and the wheelchair assassins and Lens, who is wearing these ridiculous shoes, as we know he likes to wear. And so, yeah, it's very auditory. like a film, because when they're looking at this scene, always actually, when we look at wheelchair assassins in this novel, even when we were looking at Lucien's story, his brief story a couple episodes ago, there's only one wheelchair assassin at the beginning, and then the lens zooms out and starts talking about all of the other wheelchair assassins in the room. And so I love that, how this introduction of wheelchair assassins and this moderation of nationality in this book as a device is mediated by filmic techniques, where we have really this like zoom up and then a zoom out. And the last thing I'm going to do for this thread is just sort of psychoanalyze Green a little bit. And so Green, at the end of this narrative, he's left literally hugging a tree in view of wheelchair assassins, or what I assume to be wheelchair assassins. I do want to mention that's my reading of the text, that these are wheelchair assassins, because there are so many of them. They have a particular stature, and they just don't look like an ordinarily placed person in this narrative. They just seem, they have that quality, and also they're introduced in the way, again, the way I was just explaining, this cinematic way. The wheelchair assassins are always introduced in this way for some reason within the text, so that's why I identified them as such. But I want to psychoanalyze Green a little bit, and I'm not a psychoanalyst. I know Freud very broadly. I know, you know, his broad theories and important things, but I really think that Green, as we see him, he's left hugging this tree, he's basically cowering, and he's so afraid, and he's overwhelmed, it seems like, which has to deal a lot with how his gears are starting to turn after so long. And his fear is that he's going to be identified as an accomplice. And I think that this goes back to the story with his mother, where it was him who wrapped the gift. Very clearly, it was him who wrapped the gift, because the gift was horribly wrapped. It was like a dachshund, I think the book described it as. And he was essentially an accomplice in his mother's death in some ways. I think maybe he thinks that, at least. And so, right, so it was him who wrapped the gift, who was presenting this gift to her. It was, of course, the father who was doing the real trickery behind it, because a 5-year-old cannot mastermind that. Bruce Green, at 5 years old, probably didn't even understand the joke at all. But really, I think that this feeling of guilt is going to be something important for Green's character, and something that will be lasting, and that comes from that moment when he was implicit in some ways. Again, I'm not blaming Bruce Green for his mother's death, but I think he might think that he's implicit in his mother's death in some ways. And so here he is feeling guilt almost, and feeling like he's going to be spotted as an accomplice for Lens's awful murder of this dog. The next thread here introduces that Mario's 19th birthday is on the 25th of November. Mark your calendars, folks. But he's, Mario, that is disturbed by Madame Psychosis's disappearance. Of course, we know that Joelle has been admitted into Enid House, and so she is taking a break from being Madame Psychosis for obvious reasons. She's otherwise very busy, it seems. But also, Mario's perturbed somewhat about his new inability to read Hal. So he really was priding himself on his ability to really sense where Hal was at, and now he's just having this weird blockage, it seems. It seems like he's just not having this skill in his gut where he can read Hal's emotions as well as he did when in months prior. I'm wondering, maybe this is something about Hal's secrecy and his weed usage. I'm not sure. I wonder what you all think of that. That's one of my questions for you today, is why do you think Mario is losing the ability to get a read on Hal? And we get this little tidbit that Mario doesn't feel pain very well. He has this very severe, it seems like, burn on his hip where he was leaning against an oven or a stove and got burned over the course of a conversation without even noticing. Mario also worries about Avril's worrying, and this is a tidbit about him in footnote 243. And the reason why I picked it out of the text to discuss here today is because it's another indication that Mario is mentally very developed. And so I know that this isn't going to be super impressive for the purposes of our text because we know Mario's very bright. But again, I wanted to just keep pointing this out because I think because of this really stringent theme of superficiality in the text, it's hard sometimes to get out of the mindset of like, oh yeah, Mario needs a police walk to even balance himself when he's trying to stand still. But he's really very bright, and this is another important note in the text. And so there's a recursive quality about this sentence, this thought, Avril's worrying about Mario's worrying, essentially. And so Mario's worrying about Avril's worrying, and Avril's worrying somewhat about Mario's lack of worrying. So there's this like nested recursive quality, and studies in linguistics have found that children develop this sort of quality between ages 14 and 16 or about. Some children develop it as early as 12, but this is a very advanced cognitive skill, right? So this was used in theories of reference, and I won't get into the details of the scholarship here, but again, this is some pretty advanced cognitive function, and something that really does indicate that Mario is right along track in terms of turning 19. I thought that was a good counterbalance, at least, of his superficial developments that are just always being mentioned in the text here. We learn also important that Mario has visited Ennett House and he likes it because people are real there and people discuss real topics and don't shy away from them and don't laugh at them as if they're jokes. He likes Pat Monteagian, who's very kind to him and has installed some disability accommodations for people like Mario. And he likes how people can say God unironically, and that be a valid thing to talk about in Ennett House. And so I love this bringing up of religion slowly but surely in the novel. It's another very important theme that we will definitely get to in our later readings. To counterbalance this and to really talk about it as well, ETA players do not mention or talk about real, quote unquote, real subjects in a serious life. They all are light. They always talk about it in a joking manner. There's an example with Pemulus bringing up an idea for like an atheist's phone booth of some sort where they're meaning to call their god, but it just rings and rings and there's no answer. So again, that's the kind of joking manner that Mario's used to at ETA. And then Madame Psychosis, Mario goes out on a walk. He's staying at HMH for the night, as he often does, to listen to Madame Psychosis, and he gets restless and he goes and walks near Ennett House. And Madame Psychosis, a recording from one of her earliest seasons, is playing from a window, and Mario is thinking that he's going to ask that resident, which I think at this point happens to be Joelle. Mario senses that it's a female presence. Mario's going to ask them if he can borrow some of their tapes and listen to some Madame Psychosis in his privacy, I guess, in the privacy of his accommodations. Aha, the next section is back to Gately. I'm really missing these Ennett House threads, and I'm not sure why. I think we've become pretty reliant on Gately and Gately's presence in the novel at this point, so maybe that's a reason. And there's this word that really, I think this word picayune controls this section quite a bit. And so I had to look this word up. I had no idea what it meant. PICAYUNE. The IPA says picayune in North American dialects of English. It's an informal word meaning petty or worthless. I'm just using dictionary.com for this one, not the OED. The example sentence from dictionary.com is the picayune squabbling of party politicians. Okay, so petty is a great substitute there. And picayune becoming, this picayune feeling becoming unpleasant. And so this is especially talking about Ennett House and the way Ennett House is being run, and all of this starts on page 593 for your reference. So Gately records everything at Ennett House, from medications to behaviors and feelings of Ennett House's occupants, and there's just a lot of recording, a lot of tediousness that goes around. There's a lot of policies as well, because there was a death some years ago at Ennett House before Gately got there, and that also created a lot more protocols and things that staffers, namely Gately and his colleagues, have to really look out for. And so Kate G has been in bed for the last few days in this very interesting thread that we're going through, and she's reading Sylvia Plath. And so Sylvia Plath wrote poetry, of course. She's a wonderful poet, and she did commit suicide. It was in the town gas, a series of town gas suicides in England. And so Sylvia Plath does have a history of darkness, and she's very articulate in her darkness. And so the connection that I made is, of course, Kate Gompert had a suicide attempt earlier in the novel. That's really our first jarring realization of her. We have some pieces of her from her addiction phases and what it looked like when she was addicted to her substance, which was weed. But yeah, so Kate G reading Sylvia Plath was not a good sign for me, at least, in this novel. And this is something that Gately does not pick up on. Gately also, I think his misrepresentation of Plath in the novel is plate, something like this, or plate, maybe. This connection really goes over his head, and I think it is important to make a connection to literature, especially as David Foster Wallace mentions it in this novel. So Gately is really noted to navigate the drama of Ennett House well. In this section, the reason why I'm not going over the minute plot details as thoroughly as I might in another episode is because really all of this is just drama. And the main point here is that Gately is navigating the drama super well, and his superiors are not sure if that's effective or if that's detrimental to his career at Ennett House. And I'm also wondering what the role of the narrator in relaying all of this is. You know, it's a very tedious section in many ways of relating, you know, this person said this, and you know, it's hard to get into the female section of the ward because of this reason, and Gately's had these chores for a long time. And so I know that Gately, if you are team Jim and Condensa as narrator, then you would say that Gately is very useful to Jim and Condensa because he kills M. Duplessis in the novel, of course, and we learn some things later that would really connect M. Duplessis with certain members of Jim and Condensa's family, and so we realize that, yes, Gately is very instrumental to Jim and Condensa in some ways, which may explain his connection to him. If you're on team omniscient narrator or on team DFW for this one, then of course you wouldn't make too much of those connections. You would just say, well, Gately is a really interesting part of this narrative, and he's playing an integral part that connects many sections in the novel as a whole, so that would be his importance. That's why DFW or this omniscient sort of narrator is really talking about that. I know that you commenters are very, very connected to your individual beliefs about these narrators. I'd love to hear more evidence for your individual claims and what you think about this issue of narrator at this point in the novel. I am tactfully withholding my particular beliefs at this time, just because I'd like to keep it open. I'd like to keep the discussion moving on it. And I think it's important to be critical every time you're reading a text, especially of something as important and as seemingly obvious as the narrator. And the last thread we'll talk about today is Oren, after him and the hand model have finished their business. That's my euphemism. And so, interestingly, my question is, what if Oren is mistaking a Swiss accent for a Quebecois accent? And the reason why is because there is a disabled man who comes to the door. He has no legs, and so this is another quality that's very connected with the wheelchair assassins. So they don't have legs because of their childhood game of chicken, as we remember from previous episodes. But this person who comes to the door of the hotel room to survey Oren essentially has the same accent as his subject in the room with him. And so I'm wondering, we have this thing as humans, it's called default to truth. And it means, it's strategically advantageous for us to just believe things that people say or people indicate. It's just a tactful way of living life. If you were suspicious of everything, then it would be much harder for you, and it would take a lot more time to even buy groceries, for example. But if you just believe the meat producer when they say, "Hey, this meat is fresh. We've collected it today or yesterday," then of course it's much easier to do those common things. And so Oren, when he hears that this hand model is Swiss, he has a default to truth that psychologically enables him to just accept this fact and move on. And I'm wondering if this is an error on his part, that he should not have maybe believed these people or this woman so readily. And the important thing about this section, and this is the comment really that I think we'll end on today, is on page 599. And I'm going to just read this whole rest of this paragraph here. Quote, and there's also a second quote in here. "Some of this may sound stupid. I miss commercials that were louder than the programs. I miss the phrases, quote, 'order before midnight tonight,' and quote, 'save up to 50% and more.' I miss being told things were filmed before a live studio audience. I miss late-night anthems and shots of flags and fighter jets and leathery-faced Indian chiefs crying at litter. I miss sermonette and evening song and test patterns and being told how many megahertz something's transmitter was broadcasting at." He felt his face. Quote, "I miss sneering at something I love, how we used to love to gather," page 600, "in the Checker Child kitchen in front of the old boxy cathode ray Sony, whose reception was sensitive to airplanes, and sneer at the commercial vapidity of broadcast stuff," unquote. So this is Oren talking about something he misses, which is this wheelchair surveyor's question for him. And this is really, I think this is part of the crux of the novel, really, is we're talking about postmodernism and post-postmodernism, which really says that this sort of disillusionment with entertainment and this entertainment as a cultural end-all be-all is really a problem. And so this is what Oren's identifying here, the thing that he misses, is also the thing that Infinite Jest provides. And of course, Infinite Jest is incredibly destructive. It's a tool, but it's also a weapon. And so, the other thing that I was thinking about that I did allude to earlier in this episode is that maybe I'm thinking maybe this is the golden mean of the novel. I'm really terrible at math, so I have no idea if this is like the actual golden mean spot. I'd love it if you guys in the comments would calculate the golden mean of the novel for me and tell me what page it's on, because that would be so interesting to know. But the golden mean is essentially this ratio, and it says that this ratio is naturally very beautiful to us. And so in music, we have the golden mean because, you know, a certain way, I think it's 61 or 62% of the way through a piece, that climax or that moment in the piece is going to proportionally just be more beautiful to us. And so there's a lot of interesting research behind this, and the Fibonacci sequence is involved. And so when certain buildings, certain faces have proportions relating to the Fibonacci sequence, they are more beautiful to us for some reason. And so I was just thinking about the golden mean, and I think we're near that point in the book, near the golden mean spot. And so I was just wondering, is that the crux of the novel? Is the son of the creator of Infinite Jest talking about what he misses, which is really the problem that DFW is trying to identify in the novel as a whole? If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from us, there is a show and a series for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our website, relevanceofliterature.com, under the ongoing series tab for links to our entire back catalog of episodes. We also have a couple of open surveys that you can find through the links in the description, so if you have 3 minutes while you're waiting in line somewhere, we would very much appreciate your feedback on our show. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode, and we'll see you next time.